In this episode, I talk to Kirill Kutakov from Stakewise, an Ethereum 2.0 staking provider. Stakewise wants to make it as easy as possible for users to stake their ETH and participate in the validation mechanism of the Ethereum 2.0 network, and thereby earn those juicy staking rewards. In this episode, we talk about the different staking options that are available to users, what their respective trade-offs are, the competition in the staking space, especially with centralized exchanges, and finally, how Stakewise plans to attract users in this extremely competitive landscape. But before we jump into the show, I want to thank our sponsor, Bitwala. Bitwala is Germany's crypto flagship company. They offer users in Europe a full-fledged bank account, including deposit insurance and other things, as well as an integrated Bitcoin and Ethereum wallet. So using Bitwala, you can move your money seamlessly between your euros and your crypto. They keep on adding new features, such as their recently launched Bitcoin interest account, allowing users to earn interest on their Bitcoin. I highly recommend you check them out. I will post a link in the show notes. Hey, Kirill.
Hi, Lito. How's it going?
Good, good. Yeah, welcome to the Crypto Testers podcast. As you know, I've been wanting to invite you for quite a while, but I know you guys are terribly busy. Like all the staking providers out there, you're trying to get your platform ready for the big launch. And yeah, how's it looking with that?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, first of all. And second of all, indeed, we are trying to do our best to push out the platform in December. It is looking like it's doable, although we still have a few final things to work out before we launch. But overall, yeah, quite happy with what's coming together and can't wait to get users to test it and start staking.
Yeah, I can imagine it's also quite a race to get to launch before the other staking platforms. What are the kind of barriers, or what is the checklist that you have to go through before you can launch? Because I know that all the staking providers are still in the final phases of the launch. So it seems there's quite some work there. What are sort of the biggest to-dos before we go more into ETH 2.0 and different staking options, etc.? Would be interesting to know.
Yeah, well, I cannot speak for other providers, but when it comes to us, our sort of latest, the things that we need to consider before launch is, well, complete the audits, which is one thing. They're currently ongoing and we are about to wrap them up. So looking forward to that. Second is do everything immaculately on the legal side so that we have the terms and conditions of use and make the users aware of the risks of staking, because this is quite important. And then finally, it's just communicating about the launch and trying to find the time that works best for the users and for us to like capture the attention to the launch. And yeah, maybe have a community call before that to address the sort of final concerns that people might have. Things like this. It's really both the admin and the like commercial side. But yeah, we're looking good.
Makes sense.
On both domains.
Nice. Let's talk a little bit about Ethereum 2.0, which is sort of the catalyst for this activity we're talking about for staking, because in the current Ethereum network, we're not staking, we're mining. So that's the way we achieve consensus. Now we have this new network called Ethereum 2.0. Can you maybe give us a quick recap of what it is for any listeners who are not that familiar with it?
Absolutely. So Ethereum 2.0 is really a whole new blockchain that is going to, well, some people say it will replace, some people say it will amplify the existing network. And the main idea is to make Ethereum more scalable while keeping its security component intact. So the way this will be achieved is by adding 64 shards to the blockchain called the Beacon Chain that will sort of communicate between these different 64 shards. And the idea is that by having these shards, we will be able to massively increase throughput without the loss of security. And the sort of key component of this new system is the switch from the proof of work or mining, as you mentioned, to proof of stake, which is staking. And this is a concept where users lock up a certain amount of the currency that powers a network, in our case, Ether, in order to participate in the consensus mechanism. In return, they get the rewards for doing the attestations and making proposals, you know, the usual stuff for keeping the blockchain going. And that is really sort of the crux of what's happening here. Okay. The first sort of inning of the migration to this new network was launched on the 1st of December. And since then, we have accumulated already close to 2 million of Ether into staking. And we cannot wait to participate in that with our service as well.
Yeah, cool. So basically, instead of burning energy like miners do, people are locking up capital and sort of voting on the validity of transactions. And because they have capital that is at risk, there's sort of a guarantee that they won't act maliciously or try to include wrong transactions. And if they do so, I guess there's like a mechanism to slash some of their capital. Is that correct?
Yes, this is a very good description of the advantages of proof of stake.
Okay. And this transition to Ethereum 2.0, it's happening in different phases. So you mentioned there's the Beacon Chain, which is sort of the heart of this new network. And then in the future, you'll have these 64 shards or 64 blockchains. And I think even for someone that's not very technical, it just intuitively makes sense that if we have more blockchains that act in parallel, well, then you can also have more transactions, more throughput. But this is not all happening at once, right? So what are the sort of different phases that we'll have in this transition to Ethereum 2.0?
Yeah, good question. So the number of phases is three, but they start with zero and end with two, which is for some people a little counterintuitive, but once you know it, it's kind of clear. So we start with phase zero, which is the launch of the Beacon Chain. And that's what happened in the beginning of December. And the Beacon Chain, as we both mentioned, is really the heart of the system. And for now, it will be just essentially copying the data on the Ethereum one chain, just running in parallel to it in order to sort of test the proof of stake for the future and for the current setup. On top of that, there will be 64 shards added in phase one, which is expected to land around this year. And the 64 shards will they will not be handling the transactions the way that ETH1 handles them. So there will not be execution environment yet, like no account balances, no smart contracts yet. But the shards will be there storing the data. And that's really to like phase everything over time, like gradually, to not make it too complex and to minimize the chance for making a mistake. And then the final phase, which is phase two, that is expected to land in around 18 months, is the one where really this execution environment will be possible in the shards. And it's actually expected that ETH1 will become just one of the shards of this new Ethereum 2.0. Yeah, lots of development work, lots of research that's going into this effort. It needs to be phased in order to minimize the chance for something going wrong and to like settle people in from the like proof of work into proof of stake.
With all those features, with all those capabilities, you can only imagine how hard it would be to ship all of that at once. There's so many components. It makes much more sense to put it into different phases. Although it is, of course, a bit painful for users to have to wait for so long until we really reap the benefits of all those scalability improvements. And then there's another inconvenience, which is that currently the two networks are separated, right? So we have Ethereum 1.0. On the one hand side, this is the network that we use every day, you know, where we have DeFi, everything works, everything is perfect. And then on the other hand, we have now this Ethereum 2.0 network, which is sort of like a construction site. There's a foundation is there, but you cannot really use it yet. And so we can already stake, we can already earn interest on staking activity. It has like started, but it's currently a one-way bridge. So we cannot transfer Ether back from the Ethereum 2.0 network into Ethereum 1, or we can also not, like, it's not a fully functional network where we can have wallets and send ETH to another ETH 2.0 user. It's really like the separate engine, and we have to kind of trust this to be fully functional at some point in order to have our ETH that we are staking to be fully transferable and reap all the benefits from it.
Absolutely, yeah. But over $1 billion worth of Ether has already been staked. So I guess the trust in this system eventually taking hold as the like dominant chain is quite high. And I personally have no doubt either that it will eventually be delivered the way as intended.
Yeah, no, me neither. I have been so excited for such a long time about proof of stake. And I think one thing that gets me really excited is that it makes ETH as an asset, so Ether, much more valuable, because in proof of work, users need to buy Ether to pay for transactions, which is cool. But then that Ether that they pay for transactions, it goes to miners, and the miners, they don't really have any incentive to hold it. Only if they like think it goes up in value, then they might hold it. But they really don't have a need, a necessity to hold on to it. Whereas in staking, there's a lot more chance that the validators, the stakers, will actually hold that ETH, because suddenly that ETH has a inherent cash flow. There's an ability to like use those rewards that you earn and reinvest them in order to earn more. So there's a much stronger link between like increased usage of the network and price increase of ETH, basically. What are the things that get you excited about staking?
Well, it's definitely the scalability component. So if you want to see Ether becoming the sort of the medium of exchange, we need the transaction throughput to be high. And this is precisely the promise of Ethereum 2.0. In addition to that, I kind of hope that because of offering this native, well, if we take out the like technical complexity, essentially risk-free interest rate on holding Ether in staking, then this might be pretty lucrative for the players in the traditional financial industry if they wake up to Ether as storage of value. So in the end, you know, plenty of things to be excited about. And I'm just looking forward to really, you know, Ether taking hold in the modern financial system.
You mean like institutions when you talk about traditional finance players?
Yeah, precisely. So we see that plenty of actors are currently getting into Bitcoin, but I am fully confident this will also happen to Ether quite soon. One of the sort of catalysts for that could be staking.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think also proof of stake, it's not entirely new. There are some blockchains that already use it, but I think it's just so different when it's the second biggest blockchain in market cap that switches to proof of stake, where the asset ETH is already very like solidified, the value is already understood. It's a living network with actually a lot of utility and a lot of applications. It's completely different when a new chain with nothing launches on proof of stake. Here, it's an entirely different thing. And I think one thing that makes it also more interesting is basically how easy it is to stake and make advantage of that inherent cash flow that we talked about, this interest rate. Anyone can basically stake.
Yeah, 100%. I fully agree with you. And actually, maybe for traditional players, the whole sort of staking premise is not, you know, quite straightforward, especially considering that technical complexity of Ethereum staking is a few like magnitudes higher than the other sort of blockchains. But at the same time, the sort of entry point is quite advanced even at this current date. There's plenty of staking providers who cater to institutional clients. And if the, well, traditional players want to come from the DeFi side, if for some reason they prefer that with the tokenization and and other advantages, then there are plenty of staking pools like us that would be willing to cater for their needs.
Yeah. What are sort of the different options that someone like me or like any other average user has to stake? Because I know it's much easier than mining. Like mining, it's quite established that it's not really possible for the average user anymore at home. Definitely not with a computer, but even with mining rigs, like specialized computers that you need to have, even that is not enough because you need cheap electricity. Cheap electricity, you need to be in only a certain set of countries that are able to produce energy at those low rates. So it's really not an option for the average user. And as a consequence, you only have a few people who make money with mining. Whereas now with staking, again, it's available to everyone. But what is the best way that the average user can stake their ETH and earn this interest rate?
Right. Well, staking pools, wink. Just kidding. So the staking pools are one great option, but of course it all depends on the person's preference and sort of technical background. So in general, I would separate this into three sort of main approaches. The first approach is to stake on your own, which is to get a computer rig with some medium specs, and by spending, depends on your proficiency, some amount of time on setting everything up, and by having 32 ETH at least to stake, the person can just run a rig from their home and participate in consensus from their flat, which is quite lucrative for some people, especially on the ETH staker community, for example. So if someone wants to look into that, there's plenty of guides on setting everything up yourself in that Reddit. However, the sort of drawback that many users see with that is the need to like do constant upkeep of their node and make sure that everything's running smoothly. And also the like technical difficulty of setting everything up is beyond the skills of an average user, according to many observers. So in the end, what users have as an option is using a provider who will run a validator on their behalf. And that can be done in like two different ways. So first way is to do this with like a whole 32 Ether, which is to say that a user would be outsourcing the running of the validator to some provider. They will be like renting a storage and like avoiding the technical complexity of setting everything up. They would just be pressing a few buttons and setting up their validator on the service provider's infrastructure so that the proceeds from staking go to the user and they pay a monthly fee to the provider. And then an alternative is for those who don't have 32 Ether to stake, or those who want to have additional advantages of tokens, for example, or other like services built on top of just plain vanilla staking, the users might take a look at staking pools, which offer to stake any amount of ETH without sort of the 32 ETH limit, and also like take all of the complexity away. So most of these pools charge as a percentage of the rewards that the user earns. These are the sort of free broad options. And another important thing to consider here is the way that the funds are stored with the service provider. So One option is to go non-custodial way, which means that you as a user create a validator on the infrastructure of the service provider, but you retain the withdrawal key that has access to the funds in that validator. Another option is the custodial, where the service provider uses their own withdrawal key to spin up a validator on your behalf. And that is typically the solution that is required for pooling.
Okay. So if I summarize, the first option where you stake at home, you set up all the technical infrastructure yourself, it often requires a separate computer, so to say. It's low spec, it's not as expensive as mining, but yeah, you still have to set it up. You have to run a few commands on your terminal, you have to download some things, you have to own the whole 32 ETH that are required to run a staking node. That's just like a requirement of the Ethereum network. In that case, you are completely responsible for everything. Like, it's completely non-custodial. No one can take your funds. You own the keys that belong to that validator node. But it has some drawbacks, namely that you're responsible for everything. If, for example, your internet connection is down, you can be slashed, even if some people on Twitter insist that it's actually not that bad. But still, like, there's a lot of responsibility. And then the second option, which I think is commonly called solo staking, where you're still sort of like in charge of most of the things. So you're still own the keys that belong to the validator node, the keys to withdraw the ETH once the Ethereum 2.0 network goes live. But the technical infrastructure is run and maintained by a staking provider. So they host it in the cloud. So, for example, AWS. And there you then pay a monthly fee, like a subscription, where say $10 a month or something, and they take care of everything. So it's sort of a compromise between being fully in charge and being half in charge. And then the third option is the staking pool, where really you outsource pretty much all the complexity. You just have to click a few buttons when you deposit the Ether, but there you don't have any minimum requirement. You can even deposit like one ETH, then the staking provider takes care of everything for you. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct, and it's a good description. But maybe if I could focus more on the staking pools now, yeah, since we've sort of come to their topic. The way it's looking now is that there is no minimum staking requirement in the sense that deposit can be as low as, I don't know, say 0.01 ETH or even 0.001 ETH if you don't mind paying more gas costs than you're depositing. So really, so that is one sort of advantage. Another advantage is that they will be going non-custodial pretty soon once the certain change in ETH2 specs is merged to the current specs. So the way it will work is that the users who make a deposit will eventually see their withdrawal from the pool process through a smart contract without the staking provider sort of touching any of these funds at that moment. So that sort of alleviates most of the concerns of users when it comes to staking pools. And finally, the advantage of staking through a pool is that many of them offer tokens that represent staked ETH. And this is really like ETH on ETH1 chain, but earning rewards on the ETH2 chain. The main sort of thing to consider here is the liquidity of such tokens, so that the promise of the staking pool to make your stake liquid is actually upheld. But even if it doesn't happen that the liquidity is like absolutely top-notch and you can enter and exit from staking with these tokens from the secondary market at any time, it still offers advantages like being able to transfer your stake to any address and also potentially lock it as collateral in lending protocols like Aave or Compound. So staking pools are increasingly becoming a top option as long as they remain secure and trustworthy.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you're saying that if I were to stake at home by myself, I would basically not be able to access my staked ETH until, let's say, 1 or 2 years when we reach that phase that you described at the beginning of the podcast, where basically the two networks are merged. So that is kind of inconvenient because you're putting up 32 ETH now today, but you know you can't access them until like next year or maybe even later. Whereas now with these pooled staking providers, you receive a deposit token. So let's say I put 10 ETH as a deposit in Stakewise, then I receive a deposit token that proves that I have deposited said amount. And this obviously is worth something because then I can send it to a friend and then they will own that claim on the 10 ETH in the future.
Yeah, 100%. That is correct. And I guess apologies for like quickly skipping to the token part without mentioning the fact that ETH is actually locked in Ethereum 2.0 until phase 2 lands. And this is expected to happen in around 18 months. So anyone who is staking in DIY mode or for solo without sort of the tokens will have to accept the fact that the ETH at the lock today will not be withdrawn until phase two. And for many users, this is a concern because first, many of them would want to retain the ability to exit from their position in Ether in case of a massive bull run, at least for part of their position, and they wouldn't be able to do so if this ETH were to be locked in staking. And two is that this sort of capital that is locked could actually be used productively elsewhere while it is earning you rewards. Mm-hmm. So that is really the problem that the tokens are trying to solve. You're giving users something that represents their ETH on the ETH2 chain, on ETH1 chain, and by doing so, try to make the staking deposits and staking rewards liquid and useful.
Yeah, the way I like to explain it is that when you stake and you deposit ETH in the deposit contract, you basically get an invoice from the Ethereum network that says, okay, and in 1 or 2 years, the time frame is not exactly known, but 1 or 2 years you will receive whatever you deposited plus the interest rate offered by the Ethereum network. It's kind of an invoice, but that invoice is really just an invoice. You cannot do anything with it. It's just hope. But when you stake with a staking provider like Stakewise, you receive a token that basically makes that invoice liquid, and you can sell that invoice to someone else. If you sell it to someone else, then they will basically receive the claim that is attached to the invoice, and they will be able to unlock the ETH plus the interest rate once the Ethereum 2.0 network goes live.
It is definitely a good description. I would only perhaps stress that the claim is not immediately liquid, but rather immediately transferable. Mm-hmm. The liquidity part is really ensured by the popularity of any particular token or the incentives that the staking provider offers for providing liquidity for such kind of token. So the liquidity is ensured by the demand for this sort of token in the secondary market. And as long as you have it, then of course you're fine. But if you don't, it is not immediately liquid, but it is definitely transferable and exchangeable for anything else.
Right. Yeah. A token is, first of all, just a token. The liquidity needs to come from the demand and the secondary market. That is guaranteed. But yeah, I guess that's the job of the staking platform, in this case, like you guys at Stakewise, to ensure that there is popularity and that there is liquidity on exchanges. How do you think about approaching that?
Right. So we have a very good plan for approaching this, but this has been kept secret until now. So I'm going to keep it a secret, but I encourage everyone who is interested in learning about it to join our Discord or follow us on Telegram or Twitter so that you wouldn't miss the announcement. But fundamentally, we believe to have first of all, we have a different token structure from the rest of the staking providers, which is, I guess, the reason why many people like us. And fundamentally, this token structure is more suited to have a lower discount for the token and consequently more liquidity for it. So the way this works is that instead of having just one token to represent both the deposit and the rewards, like the rest of the providers, we split the deposit and the rewards in the pool into two different tokens. So that whenever a person deposits some amount of Ether into our pool, they receive a deposit token that accrues them reward tokens as long as they hold it in their address. Or if they transfer to somebody else, this reward token will be accruing in somebody else's address. So the sort of advantage is that, first of all, both tokens are exchangeable into Ether at a one-to-one ratio in phase two. And the second is that, like, by splitting the deposit and the rewards into two different tokens, we really make the deposit token more attractive in the secondary market, because whenever it's trading at a discount, someone who sees it at a discount will buy it, pushing the price closer to a peg with Ether, to one-to-one peg. And the reason they would do it is because by buying it even at the minuscule discount, they're immediately boosting their APR until phase two by you know, a considerable amount. So yeah, that is the advantage. Whenever you bundle the deposit and the reward into the same token, you essentially lock in the unproductive part, which is the reward that cannot be restaked and does not earn anything, into the token. And thus, you actually lower the APR for the end user. And we wanted to avoid that at all costs.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So it's separating the two components of the deposit token, and it makes it easier to for any market participant to price the two assets respectively, especially the staked ETH deposit token. Which,
yeah, that's a very good description.
Okay, that is indeed really interesting. How do you see the whole competition with centralized exchanges? Because we know that Coinbase, Kraken, Gemini, they all announced that they will support staking in 2021. I think the only one that supports it as of now is Binance. But yeah, it's just a matter of time, which is also very interesting, actually, because I don't think that any of them have supported other proof of stake networks. Maybe like, yeah, maybe one or two have, but it's the first time that it's like so supported. How do you think pure staking providers like Stakewise have a chance to compete with centralized exchanges that have a lot of users, like Coinbase that has like 35 million users? What are the USPs of something like Stakewise?
Right. Well, first of all, don't get me wrong. The competition with the centralized exchanges is massive, and we need to find ways to deal with that. But the advantages that we have is that we are a nimble competitor that is focused on one job only, which is making staking for the end users as simple and as profitable as possible. With the exchanges needing to run a variety of different operations, certainly, they will try to offer the best services to their end users, but perhaps they would not be interested in offering like additional services. For example, hedging of Ether when it's in staking, or potentially offering leverage staking positions, that which are services that will undoubtedly emerge in the market to be offered by the nimble staking providers. So that is perhaps one advantage that we have. Another advantage is that the exchanges will always remain a custodial solution. So the phrase that goes, not your keys, not your money, essentially remains true. When the staking pools that are like smaller, like us, change to a completely non-custodial solution, we will not be sort of bundled into the same category, because this would enable a essentially completely trustless staking. This is a big advantage that we have for in the eyes of the people who don't want to trust the exchange with their funds. And then perhaps finally, some of the exchanges are offering staking at a massive fee. I know that some exchanges actually prefer to keep their fees low or completely eliminate them. But you know, that's a choice of a business model. I guess they will try to recoup the cost elsewhere. But if we were to take on average, then the average cost of staking with the exchange is higher when compared to a staking provider like us. So that could be another differentiator.
Yeah. Do you expect this to be a winner-takes-all market, where like one staking provider just has all the ETH just because they're more integrated into the rest of DeFi? Let's say their deposit token, I'm talking purely about staking pools right now, where like their deposit token is integrated in every lending platform, so people can use their staked ETH deposit token to borrow like stable coins, or they, you know, there's just more liquidity for it. Do you think we'll have these dynamics, or do you think it will be like a large variety of different options available on the market? I guess that would also be good for like decentralization purposes, that like not everything is with one provider. But yeah, how do you think it will play out?
Yeah, I think it's a very valid question, and the one that many people in the industry are asking. Say, my personal opinion on the topic is the following. It makes sense for the end user to distribute their funds across several operators in order to minimize the infrastructure risk. Mm-hmm. So if you were to make sure that the infrastructure that is being used by these providers is different, then by staking with several at the same time, you would, well, diversify your infrastructure risk and eventually, hopefully, come out on top, right? So I think it will be the same model as with the investment funds in the traditional financial industry. It's like, whom do you trust your money with? Do you want to put money into the pockets of the same guy who is handling money for the rest of the industry? And if so, then why do you want to do this, considering that you're centralizing your infrastructure risk, for example? Or do you want to spread your funds across several staking operators, be it exchanges or like nimble providers like us, in order to minimize the infrastructure risk and still enjoy the returns from staking? So I think that is an important thing to consider. When it comes to liquidity of the tokens, then it is perhaps a separate topic. And here, I guess what matters is to have some minimum threshold of liquidity for a staking operator. As long as it's reached, then, you know, whether you will be exiting at a, say, 20 basis points discount or a 50 basis points discount, perhaps doesn't make that big of a difference to you. But the sort of increase in liquidity, like in depth of liquidity for the token, you know, is massive in order to achieve this sort of small discount. So in the end, as long as it is decently liquid, that will be, in my opinion, enough for the end user to consider staking across multiple operators.
Mm-hmm. How much do you think, or how much more ETH are we going to see being staked? Because we know that the interest rate offered by the Ethereum network is a function of supply and demand. If there's a lot of ETH being staked, then the interest rate lowers. And at the beginning, when we had the Beacon Chain launch, we had 500,000 ETH being staked and an interest rate of 22%. Now, only like a month later, we're at almost 2 million ETH being staked and an interest rate of, I think, 11% more or less. So I would assume that most of the people who have staked until now are really like early pioneers, people who maybe a lot of them stake at home, maybe some institutions. But like now the next wave is definitely going to be like retail driven, right? People like me who are going to stake and probably with a pool staking provider. Do you have any estimate of like how much more ETH is going to be staked? Or like, in other words, like where the interest rate will settle from like 2 million now and let's say like in the next 12 months?
Right. Well, it's difficult to provide an estimation because it's such a dynamic environment that, you know, one day you have people like fully committed to Ether and then another day we enter this bear market and you're like, well, do I really want to do this? Or the opposite, you know, we enter a bull market and people start to consider whether they want to like stake Ether during that time. But what's first important to consider is that for the next around 18 months, all of the Ether that has entered staking cannot leave it. Yeah. And that will contribute to the sort of downward dynamic for the interest rate. Well, if you want to call it that, the sort of yield on staking. And really where it's going to settle is anyone's guess. We can have a few pointers though. So one of the pointers is this study that was conducted by Consensus in the middle of 2020. And it showed that on average, the DIY stakers that have been surveyed are expecting a long-term staking yield of 5 to 6% that would make staking worthwhile for them. Mm-hmm. So that could be one of the pointers. And since DIY stakers have been, as you mentioned, one of the biggest groups of people who are staking from the beginning of, from the launch of the Beacon Chain in December, then that is a pretty good indication. Another indication is perhaps the amount of Ether that is currently, or that was not that long ago, looking for yield in the DeFi space, and that could be proxied by the total supply of wrapped Ether. I think at its peak, it was close to 6 million. Mm-hmm. So if we were to consider that a big part of this is actually seeking yield in DeFi and mm-hmm. They would like to come to a staking pool to, well, benefit from DeFi-like yields or even higher yields mm-hmm. and also from the composability of tokens in different dApps, then that could be sort of the amount that you would add to the size of deposits from the DIY stakers. So net-net, my personal opinion is that we're going to settle at around 5 to 6% APR mm-hmm. in the long term. Sort of how soon this will be reached, I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
Because the rate of increase in deposits is like high, but fluctuating. And also we're still kind of hyping on the whole topic. So it's been not even a month since launch. And this is something that people pay attention to and want to take part in, maybe even for the fun of it, although they need to consider, the risks and rewards of this endeavor. So in the end, yeah, I would say 5-6 million Ether staked and around 5-6% yield.
Yeah, it's an interesting point with wrapped Ether being a proxy for the amount of Ether that is available for, let's say, speculation or investing or chasing yield. So you're saying the people who were previously investing their ETH in DeFi, lending it or whatever they were else they were doing to get a positive return on their ETH, that is a good estimation of how much is going to be deployed for staking. Have you seen the amount of wrapped ETH declining since the beginning of staking, or has it not yet been the case?
Well, actually, we have seen the amount of wrapped Ether declining to, I think, either just below or about 5 million from that all-time highs.
Okay.
In around November. So not sure. I mean, I have not seen the time series from the beginning of December for that. So not sure what has been happening to it since. But I would say that maybe it's not a good, I cannot solidly say that it's a good indicator, but it's an interesting proxy, because if we were to consider that like staking providers are offering, essentially a DeFi-like product where they're staking pools that offer tokens and, different incentive mechanisms to offer liquidity and like potentially earn some governance tokens, then this is something that could attract the users who typically hold wrapped Ether. And that's why I believe that we could take the amount of it into account when considering how much Ether is going to be staked.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would be happy with an interest rate, a long-term interest rate of 5 to 6% on an asset that I plan to hold long-term anyway. Definitely more interesting than depositing it in a bank account.
I fully agree.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the differences between different pool staking providers. I know that there are some providers that have sort of a marketplace of validators and depositors. So I think Rocket Pool is an example where anyone can become a validator in the network. And then on the other side, you have like people who deposit. Stakewise, you're not running this model, right?
No,
yeah.
We're not. And as many benefits as some people point out with the sort of marketplace model, uh-huh. I believe that there are certain drawbacks that sort of speak against it, which mainly have to do with the fact that anybody can become a node operator. And the fact that the system is not vetting them as to their technical sort of proficiency.
Uh-huh.
Although there is an economic bond that they need to submit in order to participate, the sort of disadvantage is that this bond serves to only cover for the losses of those who like end up on that person's node. But it doesn't compensate for the amount of rewards that have been missed as a result. So like when you lock your Ether, you expect it to earn as much as possible. And if for a reason that someone doesn't know how to operate the node but was allowed to do so on behalf of others, you don't generate the maximum return, would you be happy with that kind of service?
Mm-hmm.
So we see that this is a definite risk. And I think it would be great for the ecosystem as a whole if this risk were to be sort of resolved, but I don't think that it can be fully mitigated. I think that everybody who goes with the provider that offers this sort of marketplace model needs to take into account.
Yeah, and I wonder even how it works from a user experience perspective, because when you use a service like that, you go on the interface and then you deposit, and then I think in the next step they probably ask you like, okay, from in which with which of the following 10 validators do you want to stake? And as a user, you don't really have any idea of who's good at it, who's bad at it, sort of their historical performance. It's a choice that a user doesn't really want to make, or at least I'm not sure if they're in the right position to make that choice, right?
Yeah, well, I'm actually not sure whether they would be given this sort of choice. I think they should be allocated to a node sort of automatically.
Randomly. Ah, okay.
Randomly, okay. Yeah. So the only sort of point here is that there is, I think, a queue of node operators into like being able to accept users' funds onto their node. And that queue is supposed to be like sorted by certain principles, which I'm not entirely sure.
It seems like it introduces a lot of complexity.
I mean, complexity could be a good thing if it's managed correctly, because when something is complex, it means that you potentially can achieve more than the others. But there is certainly a drawback to unnecessary complexity. And for the purpose of offering the best service, this could be the case.
Yeah. I mean, so we know that the kind of performance of a validator is super important. So the capability of a staking provider to maintain the technical infrastructure, have minimal downtime, like steady internet connection, all these things. Do you have any estimate on like what a good performance would be? Like, so how much of a reduction in rewards would be acceptable in a given year? Let's say the interest rate for 1 year is like 7%. Like, that's just the raw rewards, but then there was like some missed out due to errors in the technical infrastructure. How much do you expect this reduction to be very like robust technical infrastructure?
It has to be zero.
It has to be zero. Okay.
It absolutely has to be zero. The sort of main risk, as far as I see it, from the perspective of operators that are quite advanced in their setup from like the infrastructure perspective, is the introduction of like unknown bugs by the client that they're using. So the EVE2 clients like Lighthouse, Prism, Teku, and others.
So these clients, just to quickly jump in, these clients are the software of the Ethereum 2.0 network, right? The protocol, the rules of that network.
Yeah, it's how you essentially access the data on the chain for them. So you run this node, and if there is a bug introduced in like new version or update, then this could trigger like unexpected penalties for the provider and, well, consequently for the user. But I'm quite confident that the client teams had, well, essentially over a year to develop their systems and fully test them. And we ourselves have participated in these tests for around 6 months since May and have done it for, I think, the longest of everyone, precisely for the reason that we wanted to be absolutely sure that no matter the situation, we have the most resilient setup and that we know the sort of client's behavior in and out in every sort of network state. So as long as you've done this due diligence as a staking operator and your infrastructure is immaculate, you should be targeting this zero losses.
I know that some staking providers also advertise the fact that they run different client softwares so that even if one fails, like let's say there's a bug in Prism, they can quickly switch it out for another client software so that the node is not really down, or at least it's not down for a long time. Do I understand it correctly?
Yeah. This is the sort of this is a good solution for maximum redundancy. As a provider, you would want to operate as many clients and cloud providers, or like in general, like infrastructure data centers as possible. And to like achieve an extra advantage in redundancy, you would probably want to distribute the clusters that you run geographically, so that if a data center, say in the US, goes down even for a short time, you can quickly migrate to a data center in Europe, for example.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay. Yeah, really interesting. Let's maybe wrap it up with you telling us a bit about where you are as a company and what we can expect from Stakewise in the next couple of weeks or month.
Yeah, my pleasure. So we have started developing our product around 2 years ago, when the Casper specs were, well, Casper is the original name for Ethereum 2.0, when they were originally announced. And we have been in stealth mode until, well, essentially May 2020. Then we went public with a beta, and we have been running in different testnets with it, like iterating on our infrastructure and the like the whole sort of service package since. The sort of product that we're coming with to the mainnet, and we're expecting to launch in December still, is the tokenized pool for users who want to stake any amount and want to participate in tokenization. Mm-hmm. And with the non-custodial Solo solution that is designed for users who want to essentially just host their validator with us. So the advantage of the pool that we have compared to all of the others is that we have a dual token structure versus the single token structure of everybody else. As I mentioned, there are good advantages to it when it comes to trying to achieve the smallest possible discount on the token. And additional advantage is that whenever you provide liquidity for the token, you don't actually lose out on the staking rewards. They get accumulated to a different contract and you can claim them in parallel. This is not possible for the single token structure providers. And I'm quite curious to see how they're going to resolve this issue for the people who provide liquidity for their tokens, because it is very difficult to incentivize when users essentially only gain from the trading fees, which can be quite small, especially at the very beginning. So, you know, that is another advantage of our system. And finally, we keep the APR as high as possible, regardless of the moment when you enter into our platform. But unfortunately, this is not the case for the single token structures. Whenever you enter into staking with them, like after their pool has started earning rewards, and if the growth in their deposits is not particularly high, so that the share of rewards in their pool is like considerable, then you should be prepared that by entering into staking with such a platform, you will realize a lower APR than that pool as a whole. And that is because when entering, you will also be buying a chunk of rewards that this pool has earned, and this chunk of rewards will not be productive. So, for example, from a 10 ETH deposit, if you're also buying something like one ETH of rewards, you will actually only be earning on the 9 ETH within the 10 that you bought. So You need to make sure that you account for that. No such issue with us. You just receive the deposit token, which is one-to-one with the amount of your deposit, and receive the rewards that reflect your earnings in the pool. Simple as that.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I feel like there has yet not been enough discussion on the different token models of the different staking providers and the implications of it, the different discounts. So I guess, for example, it would be much more interesting to provide liquidity to, like, let's say a Uniswap pool of staked ETH to, I'll call it Stakewise staked ETH to ETH, because there's almost no impermanent loss. Like there's no real exchange rate complexity, because the staked ETH only reflects the deposit tokens in the future, and not it doesn't contain the rewards. The rewards are separate, and so it's much more calculable how much you're gonna. It's a bit like providing liquidity to wrapped ETH to ETH, which are just two very similar assets. It's not exactly the same, but it's more similar to that than to providing liquidity to like USDC ETH.
Yeah, 100%. And the advantage for the person who provides liquidity is that there should always be demand for people who are looking for yield to buy the token, even at a small discount, because eventually it boosts their APR. So if I were to have, for example, 10 ETH and I was thinking of what to do with it, you know, my potential earnings from lending it would, I don't know, be say 5-6%. And I see that staking offers 10%. I could go directly to Stakewise and stake my 10 ETH for 10%, or I could go to Uniswap and see that, you know, the like one staked Ether token is trading at like, I don't know, even 0.99 Ether for every such token. This means that I will immediately boost the APR that I realize for the rest of the period simply by just going to Uniswap and not directly to Stakewise. But the sort of caveat to this is that whenever I buy it, I will potentially close the discount. So that's why we expect the peg on the staked Ether token is going to be, you know, quite close to just Ether. This cannot be guaranteed. I want to stress this, but the theoretical foundation for that is pretty strong.
In an efficient market, it would be arbitraged away
immediately. We're not yet in the efficient market, so there will be inconsistencies from time to time.
Cool. Well, that sounds really exciting. I will take away that staking pools are the easiest option to stake my ETH, but also diversifying, not putting all your eggs in one basket is the way to go. I have definitely put some ETH aside to put them into Stakewise, but I'll also probably one node at home. I've ordered a Vado Cloud device to do that, just for the fun of it. But yeah, I'm very bullish on this dual token structure that you have implemented, and can't wait to try it out in a couple of weeks or less.
Yeah, same. I will be staking all of my Ether with Stakewise, well, I don't encourage you to stake all of your Ether, even if you really want to. You would probably want to spare some for, you know, potentially exiting at least part of your position in the bull market. But definitely consider Stakewise as one of your options, and make sure to check out our beta before it's too late.
Cool. Thanks so much, Kirill.
Thank you, Lito. It's been a pleasure. Have a nice holiday.
You too. Hey, it's me again. I hope you liked this episode. If you did, please feel free to share it with your friends and family, or give us a follow on Twitter or LinkedIn. And if you have some feedback, reach out to me. I'd love to hear it.